So, this evening we complete the third chapter in the Life Divine. The two negations, the second being the refusal of the ascetic. To this point in the chapter, Sri Aurobindo has been speaking about a transcendent awareness, a beyond which supports and upholds and ultimately manifests all that is the universe. So we begin with the primary fact of our own consciousness, and we can grow and move from that into an awareness of the cosmic consciousness. Because consciousness is fundamental to real being. It is fundamental to nature, to both our nature and the universal nature. So there is no ground of being to which we cannot gain access and into which we may not merge ourselves, deepen, heighten, widen our awareness by dint of this identity of consciousness. So he has just in this last paragraph that we covered last week spoken about how modern psychology is coming more and more to embrace this idea. And of course, we saw that late 19th, early 20th century with Richard Bucky's book on cosmic consciousness, and we've seen it grow through the assaying of the fields of consciousness done by even Freud, but Jung, Roberto Assaggioli, Abraham Maslow, and of course, nearer to us, Ken Wilber and Dr. Washburn, who lead the transpersonal psychology movement now. A lot of attention is paid to the entire spectrum of what awareness means. And this consciousness that is the nature of our being has power. It is not impotent. It is not simply a passive witness. It can do. So now we take up this paragraph that we promised to commence with this week. Entering into that consciousness, we may continue to dwell like it upon universal existence. So he's speaking about a transcendence which can also identify itself with, merge itself with, the universal expanse of conscious being. Then we become aware, for all our terms of consciousness and even our sensational experience begin to change, of matter as one existence and of bodies as its formations, in which the one existence separates itself physically in the single body from itself and all others, and again, by physical means, establishes communication between these multitudinous points of its being. At no point does this consciousness extending itself into matter lose its singleness, lose its singularity. It becomes innumerable points of material expression without surrendering its oneness in consciousness. So, the beginning of the sentence is, we can become aware of matter as one existence, so that our experience of the world, as we grow in consciousness and assume cosmic stature by becoming one with it, allows us to experience matter as a single reality, but spread multitudinously. And in each one of those stations of apparent being, which seem in the becoming to be divided each from the other, we find simply that one basis of matter. And what is it housed in? But this all-embracing consciousness with a capital C. Mind, he goes on to say, we experience similarly, and life also, as the same existence, one in its multiplicity, separating and reuniting itself in each domain by means appropriate to that movement. So just as we experience matter as being held in this cosmic consciousness, however displayed, however diverse, it is still one matter, so too is it when that same consciousness regards the principle of life and feels all life as being one, or from the principle of mind and views all existence as being one in one vast aperspectival awareness, if I may be permitted. And he goes on, and if we choose, we can proceed farther. And after passing through many linking stages, become aware of a supermind whose universal operation is the key to all lesser activities. We want to look at this sentence. For one thing, the extension of the sentence, after passing through many linking stages, was added by revision after its initial appearance in the Arya, when Sri Aurobindo took up the Life Divine in 1939. He revised this and added this, just as he did a similar comment in the second chapter, speaking about the linking grades. He wanted to spell that out a little more. Linking stages between supermind and the operation of this triple world that we see as mind, life, and matter. He is saying here that the supermind has a universal application. This is interesting for another reason. As we've noted already several times in these few weeks, that Sri Aurobindo is writing as he's developing his yogic experience. Yogic experience, which has arrived already at two capital realizations, but now is pressing farther. Rising from the Brahmic consciousness, rising from the experience of the universal Godhead into that which is transcendent and also transformative in the nature of its power and vision. So he's rising towards the supramental awareness as he's writing these paragraphs. Week after week, his personal experience is being wedded to these pages as he's typing them. So we see in some particular points that what he's saying is virtually autobiographical. We become aware of a supermind whose universal operation is the key to all lesser activities, because it will be this supramental consciousness which will lead us to the life divine by allowing us to transform through its vision and power the instruments of mind, life, and matter. Nor do we become merely conscious of this cosmic existence, but likewise conscious in it. So not conscious only of it, but conscious in it, aware of ourselves within the cosmic consciousness, receiving it in sensation, but also entering into it in awareness. In it, we live as we lived before in the ego sense, active, more and more in contact, even unified more and more with other minds, other lives, other bodies, than the organism we call ourselves, producing effects not only on our own moral and mental being and on the subjective being of others, but even on the physical world and its events by means nearer to the divine than those possible to our egoistic capacity. So being exalted into this realm of awareness carries us beyond what was possible when we lived merely in the ego-bound individuality that we're familiar with. And again, this is reflective of what he was writing in his record of yoga, that he was finding, even as early as 1911, that his experience as it grew upwards permitted him to enter into and affect persons, things, events, forces palpably, and that he kept this careful record of how it worked. Remarkable. Nobody else has ever done that. We have no record of that from all the great practitioners of yoga, from Yajnavalkya all the way up to Abhinavagupta. Nobody ever so carefully noted down their record of experiences as did Sri Aurobindo. Of course, nobody knew that he was doing this. Even his closest associates, even the mother, when she moved to the ashram or moved to Pondicherry permanently in 1920, had no idea he was keeping this record. This was something that was completely private. But it was like the record of his laboratory experiments. So this idea that the person, as he grows into complete union with his cosmic consciousness as it is formed and shaped by the supramental presence from above, can have an effect on the moral world, the mental being, but also on the physical. So this is a consciousness that reaches down and changes even the material base of things. Why? Because matter is not the absolute plinth of being. It is consciousness that is. Consciousness has primacy. So that leads necessarily to the next. Before I go, though, I should note again that for Sri Aurobindo, experience is fundamental to knowledge. That the best means by which we understand the world is through the experience that our consciousness delivers us. It is better and more fulsome than what we could gather with the extension of our physical or subtle senses, all of whom really simply have operational utility to the consciousness that receives. Finally, we see it is the consciousness that wills and dictates. But I'm beginning to wander. Real, then, to the man who has had contact with it or lives in it, is this cosmic consciousness with a greater than the physical reality. Real in itself, real in its effects and works. So it is consciousness which is reality. That is fundamental. Existence is real when it is conscious. And as it is thus real to the world, which is its own total expression, so is the world real to it, but not as an independent existence. So this great consciousness invests the world with its own reality. and so regards it as being real. What is this speaking to? It's speaking to the monistic position that only the spiritual awareness is real and the phenomenal material world is unreal. He is scotching that right at the beginning with this phrase. But not as an independent existence. He goes on to say, for in that higher and less hampered experience, we perceive that consciousness and being are not different from each other, but all being is a supreme consciousness. All consciousness is self-existence, eternal in itself, real in its works, and neither a dream nor an evolution. So this is a transcendent being, a supreme consciousness. We are looking at what would be one of the great realizations of early Vedanta. It isn't in the Upanishads, but it appears a little later in the Brahma Sutras, where reality is described as Sat Chit Ananda. Sat is true existence. Chit is true consciousness. They are the same. They are not different. Existence is not something that has its reality apart from consciousness. It is an expression of consciousness. You could, with the same truth, say that the nature through which reality expresses itself is consciousness. So it is self-existent. It does not come into being through the action of another. It is eternal in itself. It is beyond the measurement, the divisions of time, the phases and the developments and the evolutions. It is not a hallucination. It is not a dream. It is not a figment of imagination, but the world is a real expression of this divine consciousness. The world is real, Sri Aurobindo says, precisely because it exists only in consciousness. For it is a conscious energy, one with being, that creates it. This last section, by the way, for it is a conscious energy, one with being, that creates it, was also added as a revision later to make it more clear. It really is contained in the earlier sentence, the world is real precisely because it exists only in consciousness. But this adds to it. A conscious energy, one with being that creates it. Note that he says energy. It is not sheer consciousness. Sri Aurobindo has this idea, unschooled though he was in the ideas of Kashmir Shaivism, of consciousness having also a nascent power in it. It was implicit with power, pregnant with power. Consciousness is not simple awareness. Consciousness is a force. So this idea of being, true being, having an energy of consciousness, or a conscious energy, is central to the truth of reality. It is consciousness as being that creates reality. And what it creates is real and not fictional. It is not mere ephemeral imagination that has no substance. Whatever consciousness conceives is real in some way. It is the existence of material form in its own right. Apart from the self-illumined energy which assumes the form, that would be a contradiction of the truth of things, a phantasmagoria, a nightmare, an impossible falsehood. self-standing matter is the fantasy, that matter could possibly exist on its own and not be codependent upon the deliberate manifestation by consciousness of its formation. That is what is impossible. So this, again, is Sri Aurobindo's position. Our experience of our own nature is of being conscious of our nature. That is reflected in the cosmos, and the cosmos itself reflects the transcendent awareness. It is that transcendence which gives cosmic being its truth, and which lies at the heart of individuality, which is itself part and parcel of the universal being. And as we grow out of apparent separation into oneness with the cosmic and into oneness with the transcendent, then we're better able to harness and utilize those other powers of conscious being which are transformative, which do work through the various worlds, which do influence events, people, and self. So to continue, but this conscious being, which is the truth of the infinite supermind, is more than the universe, and lives independently in its own inexpressible infinity, as well as in the cosmic harmonies. So he's stating that the supermind is the original creative consciousness, but that its home is transcendent. It is more than the universe, and is itself beyond. Remember that idea of the transcendence as being that which is beyond that transversal line which separates whatever that reality is from this triple world of our experience. World lives by that. That does not live by the world. And as we can enter into the cosmic consciousness and be one with all cosmic existence, so we can enter into the world transcending consciousness and become superior to all cosmic existence. And then arises the question which first occurred to us, whether this transcendence is necessarily also a rejection. What relation has this universe to the beyond? So there's the great question. We can, by climbing the staircase of existence, all these linking worlds, outgrow the individual and become the cosmic individual. Leave that cosmic individuality behind and merge ourselves into the supramental, which is master of the universe, but also absorb ourselves into its transcendence beyond the universe. So then, what is the relationship between that transcendent supramental reality and this cosmic existence here? We've just said, we spent all this time explaining to us that the world is real, is a genuine derivation from that being. What is the nature of that connection? Because we have to see what this experience of the transcendent means to the consciousness that merges itself into it. For at the gates of the transcendent stands that mere and perfect spirit described in the Upanishads, luminous, pure, sustaining the world, but inactive in it, without sinews of energy, without flaw of duality, without scar of division, unique, identical, free from all appearance of relation and of multiplicity, the pure self of the Advaitins, the inactive Brahman, the transcendent silence. When Sri Aurobindo began the Arya on the 15th of August in 1914, its first issue had this series at its beginning, The Life Divine. But he also translated the Isha Upanishad in that first issue. This is almost a wholesale borrowing of the eighth verse of the Isha Upanishad. Luminous, pure, sustaining the world. Here it is. It is he that has gone abroad, that which is bright, bodiless, without scar of imperfection, without sinews, pure, unpierced by evil. The seer, the thinker, the one who becomes everywhere, the self-existent, has ordered objects perfectly according to their nature from years sempiternal. I think we're permitted to bring in the Isha Upanishad wherever it's appropriate. But there is that experience of the transcendent, which is an absolute, which is immaculate, undisturbed by the movements of time. He continues, and the mind, when it passes those gates suddenly, without intermediate transitions, receives a sense of the unreality of the world and the sole reality of the silence, which is one of the most powerful and convincing experiences of which the human mind is capable. This was Sri Aurobindo's experience in 1908. To touch it again, he had begun practicing yoga as early as 1904, but it was in early 1908, January, that he sat with Lele in Baroda and immediately had this experience of the Brahmic Nirvana, the sudden awareness, engulfing awareness, that there was a that that stood behind the universe, which alone was real, and this universe, by comparison to it, seemed phantasmagoric, cinematic, but not holding any reality in and of itself. He was absorbed in that. The ego was gone. The sense of individuality had been crushed. This is interesting what he says here. It has great application even to the practice of yoga. Look what he says. And the mind, when it passes those gates suddenly, without intermediate transitions, he's written just a few sentences ago about the links between these various worlds, that you can progressively climb this ladder of existence until you reach the supramental. He has not laid out what those higher realms of awareness are at this point, but he's suggesting to us that this is not the only way to get to that transcendence, to that beyond. But if you do it this way, if you suddenly vault into that awareness, then yes, that only seems real. This down here seems, move it away. Here, in the perception of this pure self, or of the non-being behind it, we have the starting point for a second negation, parallel at the other pole to the materialistic, but more complete, more final, more perilous in its effects on the individuals or collectivities that hear its potent call to the wilderness, the refusal of the ascetic. The Advaitin will call this the self. Atman will call this Brahman, the divine. The Buddhist might call it the non-being, the shunya, the void. And if you hear only that call to the beyond, and if you dissever yourself from this world, whether as an individual seeking or collectivized as a group, a sangha, an ashram, a monastery, a mutt, then you can blot out all that the world's significance might offer to you with this exclusive preoccupation of climbing to the experience of that self, that all-negating reality above. He continues, it is this revolt of spirit against matter that for 2,000 years, since Buddhism disturbed the balance of the old Aryan world, has dominated increasingly the Indian mind. When Sri Aurobindo is writing about the old Aryan world, he's writing about the Vedic culture, the Upanishadic age, that part of India's history which was focused affirmatively on experiencing the world as an aspect of reality that we should enjoy richly but without attachment, that lifting ourselves out of egoism, we could properly and in the right way enjoy what the divine had manifested here. The Aryan, again, is one who works constantly to grow, one who is engaged in self-conquest, but also in world experience, who soars, who moves from realm to greater realm. This is the spirit of the Aryan. To go back to his paragraph, not that the sense of the cosmic illusion is the whole of Indian thought. There are other philosophical statements, other religious aspirations. Nor has some attempt at an adjustment between the two terms been wanting, even from the most extreme philosophies. But all have lived in the shadow of the great refusal and the final end of life for all is the garb of the ascetic. I don't think he could be more plain. He simply rejects that. And that is a constant in his own life. The fact that he had achieved liberation before ever he came to Pondicherry did not lead him to deny life. He never became a sannyasin. He never took a vow that refused the world. When he created an ashram, it was with the utmost reluctance because he didn't like what the word connoted, that you were moving away from the world into some sort of a refuge. He said, we're going to interpret that it means what it meant in the old days. It was the house of a teacher. Well, the term ashrama never really meant that, but we see what he's driving at. So let's read that sentence again. But all have lived in the shadow of the great refusal, and the final end of life for all is the garb of the ascetic. The general conception of existence has been permeated with the Buddhistic theory of the chain of karma and with the consequent antinomy of bondage and liberation, bondage by birth, liberation by cessation from birth. This also is true of Shankara, of course, who inherited and combated Buddhist thought and logic himself, had to beat them at their own game, in a sense. So Sri Aurobindo traces this idea of world renunciation to Buddhism. It's not altogether fair. Of course, Buddhism is the loudest voice in that way in India. Jainism actually is older than Buddhism and had a stronger sense of self-abnegation and world renunciation. Buddhism seems mild by comparison. But Buddhism took advantage of certain political opportunities to extend itself across India, to put it simply and perhaps cryptically. Therefore, all voices are joined in one great consensus that not in this world of the dualities can there be our kingdom of heaven, but beyond, whether in the joys of the eternal Vrindavan or the high beatitude of Brahmaloka, beyond all manifestations in some ineffable nirvana, or where all separate experience is lost in the featureless unity of the indefinable existence. Vrindavan, as he defines below, Goloka, the Vaishnava heaven of eternal beauty and bliss. Brahmaloka, he translates, as the highest state of pure existence, consciousness, and beatitude, attainable by the soul without complete extinction in the indefinable. In other words, this is the experience of Satchidananda. And for Brahmaloka to mean that, we have to see Brahma as a creator god who expresses the truth of Brahman as Satchit Ananda, because there is no loka in Satchit Ananda itself. Extinction, the nirvana he speaks of, not necessarily of all being, but of being as we know it. Extinction of ego, desire, and egoistic action and mentality is what he means. And that is true also of his experience of nirvana in 1908, as we mentioned. So continuing the thread, and through many centuries, a great army of shining witnesses, saints and teachers, names sacred to Indian memory and dominant in Indian imagination, have borne always the same witness and swelled always the same lofty and distant appeal: renunciation, the sole path of knowledge; acceptation of physical life, the act of the ignorant; cessation from birth, the right use of human birth; the call of the spirit, the recoil from matter. If that is true, then we must renounce life and hie away to the summits and have nothing more to do with the world. Sri Aurobindo does not choose that path, nor does he encourage us to adopt it, even though he says that there is this seminal experience at the core of that perspective, which is true. There is a beyond. There is a transcendent. So the next paragraph takes us farther. For an age out of sympathy with the ascetic spirit, And throughout all the rest of the world, the hour of the anchorite may seem to have passed or to be passing. It is easy to attribute this great trend to the failing of vital energy in an ancient race, tired out by its burden, its once vast share in the common advance, exhausted by its many-sided contribution to the sum of human effort and human knowledge. He's altered this sentence a bit when he wrote, later, may seem to have passed or to be passing, it was to replace has passed or is passing. He found himself to be a little in advance of the reality. The old anchorite spirit was still hanging on, though. The power of renunciation has not quite released its grip on India. So it is not quite gone. But we have seen that it corresponds to a truth of existence, a state of conscious realization which stands at the very summit of our possibility. In practice also, the ascetic spirit is an indispensable element in human perfection, and even its separate affirmation cannot be avoided so long as the race has not, at the other end, liberated its intellect and its vital habits from subjection to an always insistent animalism. So, simply put, the power of renunciation frees us from slavery to our senses. There is a utility in it. We seek, indeed, a larger and completer affirmation. We perceive that in the Indian ascetic ideal, the great Vedantic formula, one without a second, has not been read sufficiently in the light of that other formula, equally imperative, all this is the Brahman. This is hugely important. Vedanta is both of these things. One without a second is from the Chandogya Upanishad, 6-2-1, if you're keeping score. All this is the Brahman is the opening motto to this very chapter. It's the Mandukya Upanishad, the second verse. All this is the Brahman. This self is the Brahman, and the self is fourfold. So it has many stations of being, but this world is real. And this is the Mandukya Upanishad upon which Shankara leaned to demonstrate that the world was unreal. So it says outright, outright, all this is the Brahman. Not simply that it is one without a second. That does not mean that the world isn't real. It means that the world is part of the one. That it exists within the one. The multiple is part of it. It is not a numerical multiplicity. It is not a numerical oneness. There is only one being. There are not two. There is no division. That gulf we have to stride across with our consciousness, a greater consciousness than the dividing mind can offer. It sort of hints to us that this linked growth of awareness will be key to resolving this antinomy between matter and spirit. Matter is spirit, made dense, made concrete. So to go on, the passionate aspiration of man upward to the divine has not been sufficiently related to the descending movement of the divine leaning downward to embrace eternally its manifestation. Remember, this could not be here at all if the divine did not pour itself into it. and continues to lean into it, to sustain it with its own awareness, its own reality, its own energy. Its meaning in matter has not been so well understood as its truth in the spirit. He's speaking about this Vedantic formulation into these two great ideas. We have leaned to the one and forgotten the other. The reality which the sannyasin seeks has been grasped in its full height, but not, as by the ancient Vedantins, in its full extent and comprehensiveness. But in our completer affirmation, we must not minimize the part of the pure spiritual impulse. As we have seen how greatly materialism has served the ends of the divine, so we must acknowledge the still greater service rendered by asceticism to life. We shall preserve the truths of material science and its real utilities in the final harmony, even if many or even if all of its existing forms have to be broken or left aside. An even greater scruple of right preservation must guide us in our dealing with the legacy, however actually diminished or depreciated, of the Aryan past. So, this chastening effect that the spiritual impulse has upon us to break us free of the logjam of mere sense gratification, mere pursuit of life aims which do not take us to a divine life, which absorption prevents us from attaining the complete oneness, we shall not permit. We shall insist upon the utility that spiritual experience offers us to cleave ourselves away from inordinate bondage to the world so that we can live released and then come back and complete the world. We divinize it when we have become greater. If we are limited merely to the triple world and ascend not to the higher worlds, we can do nothing to save the triple world. We will just travel within it over and over. The Aryan is one who is always moving beyond. No attained height is final. The Aryan is he who constantly aspires, is she who refuses to submit to the old order, who always renews, always grows. Self-conquest is the very nature of the Aryan, of the noble being. So this is the perspective of what Sri Aurobindo will come to call Purna Advaita, the full non-dualism. There are not two, there is only one, but it is an all-reconciling oneness. It accepts and embraces the universe and lifts the individual to a commensurate status where he becomes cosmic, but seats himself finally in the transcendent. I think that concludes our look at this third chapter. And reality omnipresent awaits us in the next. Questions? Madan?
The question I had in my mind was about the nature of consciousness. When I think of it, or many people do think of it, in terms of awareness. You're conscious or you're aware of the world around us. And he also said that it's also full of energy. It has a force behind it.
Hmm.
It can effectuate things.
Hmm.
So then my next question is, does consciousness also include the desire self and the will and give me this, give me that kind of stuff? Is that conscious or is that mind?
If we accept Sri Aurobindo's definition of consciousness, everything is conscious. Even material formation has a consciousness implied in its being, because to be means to be conscious at some level of that universal wavelength. So material, vital, mental, supramental, and all the things that link mind to supermind, all are formations of conscious being. What seems to be absent in consciousness is not. Consciousness is there, but in a swoon, enclosed, embedded in material. Otherwise, how could life ever come out? How could consciousness ever manifest if it were not already there, implied by involution? It is stationed in matter. But where does it evolve from? From that great consciousness above, from the transcendent. So everything has it within it. And this is not simply the experience of Sri Aurobindo and mystics in India. This is also intrinsic to Kabbalistic thought, that all things, trees, stones, everything has a spiritual consciousness instinct in it. And the true mystic, the one who lives in a God consciousness, senses that and can awaken it, can give that its freedom to express itself. And so the world becomes happy when it's allowed to express itself fully, charmed by the mystic's awareness of it, because the mystic unites the transcendent to the material in his very being. And so the tree really gets to be a tree when somebody is aware that it's a tree. You see?
Mm.
And the circle is complete. Hmm. The universe is relational. There are webs of determination that if you bring a conscious intent into the world with you from the heights, it has an impact here. And the world is enchanted by the manifestation of that conscious power. The universe begins to dance. The universe begins to sing. Indian literature speaks often of how in the presence of a sage, all things come into harmony. The mongoose and the cobra will both sit at the seat, right at the feet of the sage who is realized. Flowers come into bloom, refuse to fade. They enjoy being there. You know, perhaps the story of the pranam line that used to come to meet Mother and Sri Aurobindo, and how some people could never bring a fresh flower. Their flowers would fade in their hands before they could get there. But Mother remarked, and perhaps others also saw it in the 20s, that flowers would be offered to Sri Aurobindo and they would come limp, and he would pick them up and simply be transferring it from hand to hand. He would just be holding the flower, and he would move it here and he would move it there. And at the end of 20 or 30 minutes, the flower would be completely refreshed. It would be standing luxuriantly, you know, gloriously, because of his consciousness. His consciousness had brought the flower back to life, had invested it with it, and here it was. It was in the hands of a living divine consciousness who was in a material form. All the world was complete, from the transcendent down to the material, and this flower. You see.
So. Do you believe in crystals that consciousness can be more easily awakened in some forms of matter like crystals? And
I think the way the mother put it, it was that some things are more capable of holding and transmitting a consciousness, that if you have attained a yogic power and want to invest that power in something, perhaps a stone or a flower or something will be able to hold it and transmit it to a recipient that you wish it to have. Or the presence of a mystic will make a space sacred, simply by having been there, not because the lines of geometry around the globe have conferred that status, but because that being has realized. Then that ground becomes sacred. Happy things want to happen around it, you know. And what do those happy things tend to be? But the revelation of the innate power that that thing possesses. So a crystal might be one way. I think amethyst was a stone that Mother felt had a particular receptivity, that she could put something in that and it would last indefinitely. The rose petals that were placed in little packets and given out as blessings packets, you know. Mother said, I put my consciousness into that. These are rose petals that have been in Sri Aurobindo's room. I put my consciousness in them. And they are intended to hold that power for precisely a year. So when I give them on the birthday, it's meant to empower your sadhana for a year, to help you. If you know how to use the blessings packet to find its inner utility, then you can make the most of it. She said, but most people don't know. They're happy to get it. They're happy to receive it. But they don't really know what to do with it. For that, you have to grow inwardly aware.
Mona's question and your answer sort of begs the question for me is, how is it that we are, by some luck of the draw, able to be in a form of consciousness that is able to contemplate these things and perhaps a tree or a rock or a chair sitting in is not doing that? Have we, as we grow in consciousness, do we encompass all greater things? And then that's as we begin to identify ourselves as a greater and greater part of the whole and heading toward that point of
being. I'm going to go back to the first part of your question, if I may, which is how do we come here? And I think it, you said by the luck of the draw, and I think to regard it as a grace is a fortunate way to look at it. I think that is a good attitude for us, not to have the sense of deserving that implies a kind of demand that, yes, we are here and we got here because, by golly, we deserve it. There's some truth in that, of course, that we've come to this universe long back and evolved slowly over untellable epochs of time to inhabit this human body, and now to have awakened to this possibility of continued conscious growth, to reach for a reality behind the surface of our phenomenal existence, and live from the power of the soul rather than from the constructed ego, and find in that experience that we are one with the cosmos, and to discern a hand shaping the cosmos, to discern a being beyond, of which this cosmos is a figuration, and which stands at the very center of our own nature, to come to this kind of awakening is wonderful. Adbhuta, adbhuta. It's great. But all things are great. That which seems not to be great just hasn't come to its hour yet, you know? And the growth of consciousness is sure. One cannot but grow. Because if you wait too long, if you idle about too much, nature will begin to kick and strike at you, to push you along. And karma will have to be your teacher. There is a truth in the idea of karma, but karma is a lower enginery intended to keep the cosmos moving and working, where if we find the conscious intent, we no longer have to learn because of the lessons or through the lessons of karma, but we're able to be self-directed and work without that chain of causation which karma implies. And then we can be free, and that is the kind of moksha. Then we are impelled by communion with the higher will, which then expresses its will through us in the cosmos. I know I'm wandering, but I hope I'm wandering in happy fields.
So basically, transcendence is not a rejection. That's this chapter.
Thank you for summarizing. Yes, that's right.
What does that mean? Good chapter.
So, I should mention that we get into some beautiful work next week with it. I should also mention that today is the 80th birthday of Leonard Cohen, a Canadian poet who is important to some of us. And we are on the cusp of the autumnal equinox, which is poise of balance in the annual cycle. So, all good things, as they say. Oh, I want to mention, I'm not going to forget this, our friend Bill Flick reached his 70th birthday. He is 70 years complete yesterday. So, he accepted greetings from all of you. Looks forward to seeing us whenever he can get down here. But any of us traveling to Atlanta are more than welcome to stay with him in Auburn. So,
He's doing well.
Yes, yes. So, I think we will go for our meditation now. Jai Ma, Namaste.